This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Shaoning, and joining me in the studio is, of course, Philip C.
Good morning.
Good morning. How was your weekend?
Very nice. I had long walks again.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think it's going to be one of those last few days where there won't be much traffic. Because come this Monday, chang, 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 it's school day.
I know. For a lot of kids, I was talking to my nephew, right? And I was like, so bad. The most horrible aunt. I was like traumatizing him. I was like, so how? Ready for school or not? Huh?
You're going to embarrass yourself because all these days working at home, now you're going to embarrass yourself that not knowing your skills in place?
No, like, he's 8 years old. That sounds like a job interview prep, okay? These poor kids. Actually, if you ask me, I'm sure parents are a bit of a dilemma, right? Because,
yes,
you know, COVID-19 is still here. The cases are still high, above 2,000. Parents are anxious. So, like, even my sister is torn between the safety of a child, but also the development of the child. And I think whatever said and done, staying at home for 1 year has not been great for kids. They miss their friends. They miss the interaction. They miss the schooling system. Mm. And even if you're a very dedicated parent, like I would give my sister a bit of credit, most parents are like, "Ayo, cannot continue. You know, it's tiring looking after this kid and schooling him." My sister finds that she just doesn't have the skill sets as a teacher does.
Yeah. I'm hearing a whole series of sighs all around the Klang Valley. Is it a sigh of relief? Like, yes, get out of the house. Or is it a sigh of despair, which is,
I think, a bit of both.
I'm not sure whether it's going to be safe. How are they going to adapt and adjust back to the new normal? Those questions.
I think every parent will have some anxiety. The kids themselves will have some anxiety. So ginger steps, I think, is the way forward.
I think so.
And the main thing, of course, is to stay safe, practice those SOPs. And if you're a parent, do let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio about your feelings this morning. But in the meantime, what do we have, Philip?
We're going to talk about Bill Gates' new book and what he mentions about green premiums.
Oh, interesting stuff from world's richest man. Is he still?
No, I think he's like been overtaken by Elon and
Bezos, right?
He's like.
And when we come back, we're going to be talking about another billionaire. Well, actually, his company, Facebook, and the fact that it has an oversight board. Like I said earlier, you can get in touch with us via WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll have more for you in a few minutes. But first, here's Last Train to London by Electric Light Orchestra. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was the uber cool Last Train to London.
Love that song.
I know, by Electric Light Orchestra. And personally, I'm dying to get on the Last Train to London.
Flight laughers. We take flight.
I don't know. I don't mind. I just want to go on holiday. But unfortunately, no holidays for us yet. And it's something we will be discussing at 7:15 later this morning about whether we can travel and, whether there's hope for the travel industry. Because I think over the weekend, the DG did come out and say something about when is the right time.
Yes, 70 to 80% had to be vaccinated before interstate, inter-district travel would be allowed.
I know, so a bit of a
wait
there.
That's a pretty high bar.
Yeah, it is. So do listen at 7:15. We're going to have a call with Yap Lip Sing, who's the CEO of the Malaysian Association of Hotels. But in the meantime, we are talking about the one and only Facebook.
Yes, and this is an article in the New Yorker about how the back behind the scenes on how this oversight board was created. It also comes on the back of an interview with one of the members on Wall Street Journal, because it has to make a very important decision soon, which is, will they allow Trump to return to Facebook?
Okay. Do we want him back? And like you said, the New York article is called it's entitled Inside the Making of Facebook's Supreme Court. And I think this is interesting because I think, 2 billion people use Facebook, something like that. I mean, when you think about it, it's about one third of the world's population.
Yes.
Some people say, no, they don't use Facebook anymore. It's only for old people. But I think it's okay. I love it because it helps me get in touch with friends I would not otherwise
see and news.
And it gives me a little peep into other people's lives. And it allows us to connect, especially in this COVID-19 era, right? So for my friends who are, let's say, overseas, I can still see what they're doing, what they're eating, where they're going. So a little glimpse into people's lives. But I think it has become such an important social media tool. It brings up ethical questions, right? And the question of freedom of press, freedom of speech, for example. Facebook, of course, having a war at the moment with the Australian government. That's one issue that's still outstanding, whether they should pay for feeding Australian news into their website or into the social media. That's one issue. But today's issue is slightly different. It's as if, you know, should you allow certain content on Facebook?
Right. It's a balance between freedom of press versus protection of human rights. So you said a very interesting 0.2 billion viewers. So imagine Facebook was a country. So the oversight board is an independent content moderator. So applying it to a country, it's the Supreme Court.
But not entirely, not right? Entirely. Because we have discovered certain nuances, haven't we?
So what they do is how is it funded to ensure its independence? It's going to be super critical.
Only 130 million, if I'm not wrong. US dollars, by the way.
In funded, a trust fund.
Funded by Mr. Zuckerberg himself. Well, Facebook's money. Yeah. And this is real money, by the way, not shares.
Sure. But it's a gallant effort, I think, to at least have some independence and to make sure Mr. Zuckerberg doesn't have the final call in all these decisions. And so far, it's made seven decisions so far, and one of them involves Malaysia.
Oh, okay. Yes. This is news to me.
Right. And one of them was Tun Mahathir's posting.
Oh, yes.
Right. And someone had made an appeal, but that person dropped the appeal. And so the board did not adjudicate it.
Oh, okay. Is that why at the end of the day, there have been only six judgments, I think?
Exactly. So there were seven, but six only were judged. And one of them involved also Myanmar.
Okay, and this is over the treatment of Rohingya refugees, right? Yes. Because I listened to this podcast by the Wall Street Journal, and they interviewed the Danish Prime Minister and why she came on board. And she explained the role she plays in this oversight board. And of course, there are question marks about really how much independence does this oversight board have? Do they have far-reaching powers? Can Facebook actually overturn their decisions? And at the end of the day, are they just a rubber stamp, legitimizing what Facebook has always been doing, which is actually just following Mark Zuckerberg's decisions?
Yes.
And I think her point was she talked to Mark Zuckerberg that personally, and she said that no, he will not interfere. But I still have questions at the end of the day, because whatever they say or whatever they do is not actually policy, because they make judgments on those particular cases. And it's not like it becomes common law.
Yeah.
Or, you know, kind of like a statute. What it is it's just based on that case. And then it's the question mark of what other cases come before them.
Yeah, so it's case specific, as you say. It doesn't really set things into institutional outcomes per se. And I do think it's a function of the quality of the oversight board.
Which there are already question marks, right?
That's right. It's a diverse board, to be fair. Multiple countries, and there's even actually the Jakarta Post editor who's a member of it. But you have to make sure that representation is across all political spectrums, all ideologies as well, and backgrounds, which they're trying to do. But you have a good point. How long is this sustainable? Because actually it's been around for nearly a year so far, and it's only made seven critical judgments. The big one is the Trump decision, whether or not they will bring him back into Facebook.
Well, just to give you some idea of the work involved, right? I think, and how much they're being paid, you know, as usual, I'm very capable. I love this, right? So apparently the oversight members are paid six-figure salaries for putting in about 15 hours of work. And like you say, Philip, it is managed by an independent trust. So Facebook, like I said earlier, $130 million. Now, the issue is how much work can they get really done? Because according to Facebook, as many as 200,000 posts become eligible for appeal every day. So who decides what case goes before this oversight
Absolutely.
Committee?
Absolutely. Because it has to filter down to the 200,000, to then the thousands, and actually only the panel reviews a selection of 50, 60 cases at a time. So I think you have a very good point about the filtration process in selecting the right cases.
Yeah, and of course, the big case, Trump. What do you think the oversight board will decide?
Well, Wall Street Journal did ask her. She refused to divulge.
Well, it would be rather unethical for her to say at this juncture, right? You have to wait for the judgment to come out. But what does it signal to the rest of the world when you basically say to the ex-president, sorry, your access to 2.2 billion people is restricted?
Interesting point, because, you know, she made a point also that people in positions of power are also kind of looked at With a different filter as well.
Of course, they are held to higher standards, right? Let us know what you think. Do you think Trump should be back on Facebook or not? You can, of course, WhatsApp us at 01-8789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we have some messages for you. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was The Old Pair of Jeans by Fatboy Slim, which I hope I still can get into. especially after Chinese New Year.
I personally did not agree. I could not believe it when there was a survey that said that I think 40% of Malaysians lost weight.
Yeah, I think that was a lie. That was a badly done. That was a badly done survey. I'm not sure who they interviewed, but it wasn't us.
Yeah, definitely. I'm like, who is that?
Yeah, after guzzling like the, you know, like the 50th pineapple tart, I'm sure those jeans don't fit anymore. But anyway, it's just gone past 6:19 in the morning. It's Monday, and it's, of course, the 1st of March. It's the first day of March already. Where did time go?
1/6 of the year is gone.
I know, blink and it's gone. But in the meantime, I think what we are discussing, which is unfortunately gone, is our ozone layer, right? That's a sad thing. And this is in relation to the article in Time magazine. And it's by Bill Gates. Yes, yes. One of the richest men in the world. No longer the richest, but one of still. And it's entitled, Here's a Formula That Explains Where We Need to Invest in Climate Innovation. And we do know, of course, he's running this Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And the ethos of that foundation is everyone deserves the chance to live a healthy and productive life. And I think that's so true. Earlier on, last year, his focus was very much on vaccines, right?
Yes.
And now he's kind of shifted a little bit and it's towards climate change. But why is it so important?
Yeah, well, the evolution has been, when he first started, it was about addressing basic needs for the poor, especially in Africa. And as you said, rightfully, last year, he was really in the headlines because of COVID. But he's now switched attention to renewable energies. And he's got a new book coming out called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. How ominous is that?
Yeah, very ominous, actually, coming from the man that created Microsoft, or one of the creators of Microsoft. I think his point is about, you know, how, you know, he himself is thinking about how the world could make energy more affordable and reliable for the poor.
Right.
Without burning fossil fuels, right? Because his point is basically we need to eliminate our emissions all the way to zero. But it's very easy to tell people these lofty goals. Go and do it. Go and do it.
Yeah, go and do it.
But really, when you're poor and your excess is really just fossil fuels, what options are you giving people? Mm. None, right? So how can you then, you know, come from your high horse to dictate to them what to do, especially when they're just really concerned with the day-to-day living as made worse by COVID-19?
Yeah, so I agree with you. I don't see the connection between his attempt to address the poverty, but his point is about this concept called green premium, which is what is the additional cost it takes to move from a carbon-emitting economy to a zero-carbon-emitting economy. And putting a number to it is the premium that people are expected to pay, or governments are expected to pay, to bring us back to a zero-carbon economy. I think it's a very geekish approach to put a number to it, because then people can understand and quantify the effects and impact. So it gives a very good example, for example, right, which is, okay, average retail price for a gallon of jet fuel is $2.22. Now, if you want advanced biofuels for jets, it will cost on average $5.35.
So
green
it's
premium,
double.
Yes, it's double. And the delta then is $3.13. That's the green premium. But that's a premium of more than 140%.
But who will pay that premium? And do people want to pay?
Good point.
Or do governments pay?
Correct. So now the question is, you know the number. What do you do with the number, right?
Yeah.
Correct. So does government subsidize the premium? Or do we as citizens say, all right, let's make this work, drive economies of scale to make this work so that we can bring the green premium down further?
Which, yes, we have seen. I think if we use the example of solar panels, I think that's a classic one, right? If we rewind 15 years ago, solar panels actually have come down as much as 70 to 80% as there's far more production, right? Mm. So now it's possible, I wouldn't say it's cheap, but it is possible for you as an individual to put solar panels on your roof to generate electricity. And there is the infrastructure where you are plugged into the Tenaga grid.
Right.
And you basically use what you generate, and then the balance you actually sell back to Tenaga. So it is, what are, the point is that there has to be this combination of government policy, corporates working together, and you
consumers.
And consumers, you making that decision to pay for that solar panels, which still cost between 5,000 to 7,000 ringgit for a normal terrace house. But the point is, all this makes, there are different decisions that need
Absolutely.
To be made at every level, right?
Correct.
So who starts? Do we tell the government, okay, start, because you need to roll out green policies at the very top, and then you need corporates to have the buy-in, and then individuals also, which is great. I think this ultimately kind of ecosystem works. But what about in an economy which is struggling and, you know, where people are poor? How do you get them on the bandwagon and then show them the benefits of this green economy?
Yeah, so because we are going into a situation where there might be finite resources, the green premium helps us pick options. Which is the best pathway to get to zero carbon? And if you're able to identify which are the best options, then you know, okay, I'll put my money where it really counts. So there was an example about EV vehicles, right? Where, of course, in Norway, it makes a lot of sense because the whole background of the electricity back generation background is renewable mostly already. But in somewhere like Germany, where it's still coal producing, why would you put incentives to drive EV vehicles there? Because it still doesn't bring down the green premium substantially lower. So it is a very interesting fact-based tool to understand what are the options you take. Now, I agree with you, poor countries really don't have the resources. So then how do governments help make those options better?
But I think it's important that governments actually think about this and make baby steps towards this. But let us know what you think. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we have the news bulletin. And to take us there is River Deep Mountain High by the Supremes and the Four Tops. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9 is just gone past 6:40 in the morning. It's Monday, the 1st of March, and you're listening to Xiaoning and Philip on The Morning Run. And that song was Loveful by The Cardigans, by the way.
Are you trying to get your kids out into the car now?
Well, this doesn't apply to us, but it probably applies to a lot of Malaysians today whose kids are like, school, what was that?
We didn't wake up.
Wake up. I think the wake up was probably...
Hurry up. Get into the car now.
Eat your toast. Wear your uniform. Pack your bag. Let's go. I'm sure these conversations are happening over many, many households today. And we wish the kids all the best.
And
we
also parents.
And parents, lots of patience. Good luck. Stay safe, okay? But in the meantime, we are looking at some of the headlines around the world. And first off, of course, is Myanmar. Because, unfortunately, the democratic protests there have turned deadly over the weekend. With reports of the military using live ammunition and tear gas against demonstrators across the country. So the UN Human Rights Office said there have been at least 18 deaths reported and some 30 injured as a result of the violent crackdown. So the UN Human Rights spokesperson has condemned the violence, saying that the use of lethal force against non-violent demonstrators is never justifiable under international human rights norms.
Yeah, so this is 1 month anniversary since the military coup took place, right? And the government is contending with a growing civil disobedience movement that is causing massive disruptions to economic activity. So, but meanwhile, representatives of Aung San Suu Kyi's toppled government are really trying to consolidate efforts by securing international recognition. And if you were listening to the United Nations speech where the Myanmar's ambassador appealed for international help, I think the ambassador has been summarily been dismissed.
Yeah, he has been sacked. It came out on the news in Myanmar. So this ambassador actually even used the three-fingered salute, the sign of defiance against authorities that have been adopted by protesters in the region. So state media, like I said, announced his dismissal for betraying the country and speaking on behalf of an unofficial organization that doesn't represent Myanmar. Now, the junta has also ordered foreign embassies, UN agencies, and other international organizations in the country not to talk to illegal entities representing Aung San Suu Kyi's political parties. Now, meanwhile, Southeast Asian governments led by Indonesia are seeking to defuse the crisis and last week held talks in Bangkok with the junta's foreign minister. The meeting infuriated supporters of the NLD who are calling for the results of the November elections to be respected.
Yep.
What I think is really surprising is they've gone to see the Thai government, which, by the way, is also military, to seek some form of I suppose, affirmation. So we'll nonetheless be watching this space very, very closely, and hopefully the level of violence will come down. But for more on the potential economic impact of the military coup and political uncertainty, you can listen to our podcast with Linda Liu, an economist at Maybank Kim Eng. We'll also be covering Myanmar during Pressing Matters later today at 9:30 a.m., where we speak to journalist Zaya Tu on the protest movement. But in the meantime, let's turn our attention to the recalibration of relations between the US and Saudi Arabia.
A really diplomatic term, recalibration. But over the weekend, the Biden administration released an intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had approved an operation to capture or kill journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. In the wake of the report, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced a visa ban on 76 Saudi nationals believed to have been involved in threatening dissidents overseas. However, no sanctions have been imposed yet on the Crown Prince himself. But I believe an announcement will be made today about the future of US-Saudi relationships.
Well, if we know anything about Saudi Arabia, is that MBS, or the otherwise known as Crown Prince, has his hands in everything, right?
Yes.
He's the heir designate. And of course, he's trying to bring Saudi Arabia into the 21st century. He listed Aramco, modernized the state, allowed women to drive, gave some civil liberties. But at the same time, there are actions like this, you know, the murder of a journalist at the Turkish embassy, the Saudi Arabian embassy in Turkey, shocked the world. Now, of course, Saudi Arabia said it rejected completely the negative, false and unacceptable findings of the US intelligence report. The Saudi government has denied any involvement of the Crown Prince in the scandal. Riyadh eventually admitted that Khashoggi was killed in a rogue extradition operation gone wrong. And last year, five men were sentenced to 20 years in prison for the murder. But all this, does this really change US-Middle East relations?
I think it will have profound effect because if you recall, during Trump administration, he really tried to broker a peace deal, right, partially. But there's so many moving parts now with Qatar, Middle East, and with Iran and Saudi. I'm really interested to see how all these pieces fall together now.
Yeah, something I think pressure on Biden to get his foreign policy working and getting all the different factions within the Middle East to work together. But give us your thoughts. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we'll be taking a look at the front pages of our daily newspapers and online portals. We'll be back after these messages. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was Lighten Up by Parcels. That was an interesting name for a band. It's just gone past 6:51 in the morning. It's Monday, the first day of March. And of course, you're listening to The Morning Run with Philip C. and I'm Wong Xiao Ning. Now, Philip, headlines. What's interest you in the papers this morning?
I'm going overseas and I'm going straight to the United States. Two big pieces of news there. The first one is the House has passed the US $1.9 trillion stimulus package by President Biden's administration by a narrow majority. Now, that will go to the Senate. I think there will be a lot of horse trading going through there.
So that one is going to be a difficult challenge.
That will be a difficult one. So we will see whether or not a reconciliation process will have to take place there in the United States. So that's one big piece of news. The second news is that the vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, was approved in the United States. Now, that's a big vaccine approval because it's only requiring one shot only. And so the United States has ordered 20 million of those doses. And apparently even distribution logistics is quite smooth. I saw Kyrie's tweet over the weekend, Kyrie Jamaluddin, our minister.
Yes.
He also said that we had ordered the vaccine, but he made a bit of a complaint that the Negara Maju bolot, or basically are just taking or hoarding all these vaccines because they're quite valuable.
And the other interesting thing about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is it doesn't require minus 70 degrees Celsius,
yes,
right? So it's a little bit easier to transport. And staying on the topic of KJ, Kyrie, he has come out to openly say he will take any vaccine. He doesn't need to take the Pfizer because he wants to prove that all vaccines, as long as approved by the government, are good to go. And really, truly, that is the case because the I guess the level of testing to get the green light from the government is not an easy one. Now, I'm looking at the Star and I'm going a little bit businessy, and this is on page 2 of the Star Business. And it says Ralph Marshall to be appointed 5G SPV CEO.
I know.
Now, for some of us who don't know who he is, he used to run Maxis and Astro and is AK's right-hand man, if I'm correct.
Yes.
AK being Ananda Krishna, one of the richest men in Malaysia. So now Ralph Marshall is apparently back in the corporate world because he'll be heading the board of directors, and the special purpose vehicle as chairman will be Tunku Datuk Sri Zafrul. So he's going to run it.
Well, Ralph Marshall is a safe pair of hands. Of course, he has a certain reputation to him, but he does know the industry very well. And I think probably necessary skill required to manage this 5G SPV.
Well, a source also said that the board will comprise professionals that will be chosen to put in place the right people to have oversight of the project. Marshall's experience in starting the rollout of the Maxis network apparently gives him the experience and the credentials to do so. Of course, we have heard that the SPV will be investing $15 billion over a span of 10 years to bring 5G services to the country. We've also heard from Fitch saying that this is not the best way forward. Why is the government involved in private enterprise?
Yep.
Question marks over procurement, question marks over who runs it. Well, at least we know who's going to run it as of today. But we'll be watching this space very, very carefully. I'm also curious
yes.
whether at the end of the day, consumers will benefit, whether they will pay lower prices for their 5G.
Actually, over the weekend, a lot of articles about the 5G SPV, you see on the edge a more balanced view of the pros and cons and its implication, especially for the tower business. And if you go to the Vibes, I think Gunnar Segrin also has written a pretty scathing commentary against the 5G SPV proposed.
Well, even the Edge also did say, do what's right to rebut the Fitch on 5G. And that's, of course, in their column, frankly speaking. Yes, I guess when you see the headline sums $15 billion, everyone's very curious how that $15 billion will be spent. And at the end of the day, is there going to be transparency? Like I say, consumers, they ultimately pay the price. So hopefully we're going to pay less price or less for our 5G.
Well, okay, one article I see is Petronas cut its annual capex to 40 to 45 billion ringgit. We're going to talk about that quite extensively at 9 o'clock. But just to share, they did record their first ever loss, I think last Friday, right? 20 to 21 billion loss, taking over 35 billion asset impairment. But we're going to deep dive that, I think, at the 9 o'clock show.
Yeah, but I think the little bit of good news is, of course, that they've committed to spend capex on in terms of the oil and gas industry. So a little bit of cheer there for the oil and gas players in Malaysia, because I think last year when oil prices hit 30 US dollars a barrel, WTI, there was a lot of nervousness about how much capex was going to be cut. And it wasn't just Petronas, right? It's basically every national oil company. But I'm curious in the long term, as oil and gas companies become green energy companies and are focusing on renewables, what does this mean for the oil and gas service providers in Malaysia?
I was doing some research about, you know, this whole concept of green premium in Malaysia, and I was looking at Malaysia's energy source. Interestingly, 60%, or not interesting, 55 to 60% of our source is actually natural gas.
Yeah, it is, because we still export natural gas, not much oil. But very quickly, MBank slapped a 2.8 trillion billion settlement related to the role in 1MDB's 2009 5 billion bond issue. This was rather unexpected, because so far as we know, MBank has always said that the matter had been closed. So a bit of a surprise for them, and this of course hits their shareholders' funds, but they have come out to say that the bank can absorb it. But that's all we have for you at this moment. We're heading into the 7 a.m. news bulletin, followed by, of course, more business news and analysis, where we'll be finding out where global markets are heading with Kingsley Jones of Jevons Global. But first, here's Signed, Sealed, Delivered by Stevie Wonder. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.